Yeah, well, when you refer to the Gulf states,
I'm not very new.
No, well, when you refer to the Gulf states as you know, corporations masquerading as nations, it's not an exaggeration. If you look at the countries like Qatar, I think it's only 10 to 15% of the population are Qataris. The last 85 to 90% are just foreigners. So it's just oil in a desert, and they build up real estate around it. They build up the energy markets, and the problem is, if things start to go south, because the people themselves would leave, it makes everything very difficult. And so it's not even just the technical issues which you refer to, but if the goal now of Iran is to expel the American bases, and if the Gulf states are unwilling to decouple from the US, then they will essentially go after the survivability of these states. As you said, there's many ways. Attack a desalination plant and there's no more water. Again, it's a desert. If the workers begin to flee, then the whole country shuts down. It just seems that how much of the global economy depends on these, you know, corporate states. It's quite incredible. So, but it kind of begs the question as well, though. How do you see Russia linking itself into Iran here? Because I guess the question on many people's mind would be, after, you know, having spent the past years of NATO being using Ukraine as a proxy against Russia, it seems as if Russia could end up in a similar position. That is, if it hands over some missiles, I'm not sure if Iran needs it, or targeting data. Do you see the possibility of moving this direction, or does it depend on the extent to which the Europeans get involved in the Iran war?
Look, Russia's already there. I mean, let's talk realistically. This isn't a question of whether Russia will give targeting information. It is giving targeting information. So is China giving targeting information. And China is now becoming, what you just said doesn't apply to Russia, because Russia was already there from day one. The Chinese now are starting to look at, they're mercantilist. I mean, they always were. They're not a military culture. They never were. They're more of a trader culture. They like to trade. They're not big on military conquest. They've been conquered many times, and they just assimilated those people and continued business as usual. But now they're looking and going, I think the Iranians are going to win. And success breeds success. And now they're going, well, you know, we could invest. Maybe we could push this forward. Russia's been there from day one. I mean, there was complaints coming in from the second day on Iranian drones, where they opened them up, and it's Russian chips powering the computers on these drones, with Cyrillic written in there, the name of the companies, everything. Russia, they're Russian. I mean, okay, I'm not going to say this straight out one way or the other, but it takes a year and a half to train a MiG-29 or a Su-35 fighter pilot. Not 4 months, not 5 months. It takes a year to train up an officer to be able to control and command the S-400 control command block. Not 3-4 months. So right off the bat, you can make your own conclusions of these things that are being operated. You know, everybody's smart enough. I think they can make the conclusions that they need to make. There's Russia supplied Iran with a lot of upgrades in equipment over these 6 months that made their systems much more lethal. Avionics, propulsion, targeting, heads-up displays for legacy aircraft. They put in jamming systems, modern jamming systems. We've seen, and these are all field-tested variants. I mean, Russian missiles have heat flares on them. If you ever look at it, Russian ballistic and cruise missiles have heat flares like an airplane. So whenever the Ukrainians are trying to shoot them down, they just start shooting off heat flares as they're flying. It's an interesting little sight to see. The first time I saw it, I was like, oh, that's an interesting advance. The Garand 3s are basically, Zelensky is complaining. Apparently, Russia's production is big enough that they can afford to ship them to Iran. Israel hit the Caspian Sea, where Russia gave it a very stern warning not to try to get in there. Otherwise, there'll be bad consequences for the Israelis, because now they're messing with the Russian-Iranian trade, and a good chunk of that trade goes without transponder signals. You can put two and two together to figure that one out. So Russia's already there. Yes, of course, Russia's going to be proxying the U.S. The U.S. has been proxying Russia for 4 years and admitted to it, even though Trump then comes out, oh, it's not our war. Yeah, it is your war. It is now your war, Mr. Trump, because you have not divorced yourself from Biden's war for the last year and a half. So it is your war now. Where it goes from here, I don't know. But Russia and Iran, I mean, for Russia, the fall of Iran is a existential crisis, just a bit less than Ukraine. Because if Iran falls, it opens up Central Asia and the Caucasus to import of NATO and U.S. Destabilization, Islamic jihadists, and so on and so on. And then that threatens directly Russia's borders and Russia's integrity, special law on the Kazakhstani border, which is 3,000 kilometers long. And there's no way in hell Russia is going to tolerate that. Sorry, we'll fight to the last Iranian and Russian while we're at it. And the U.S. is not going to win there. In fact, everybody's waiting for the U.S. now to put ground forces in for the massacre to begin. I mean, the Iranians are flat out said. There was an interview with I can never remember the guy's name, foreign minister of Iran. I don't know if you remember his name. I always forget his name.
Yeah, Charia. I forgot. Oh, it's...
Yeah, I see his face, but I'm horrible with names. So no offense to anybody in Iran. And they said, aren't you worried about how the Americans are coming? They're going to do ground forces? Like, we're waiting for them. I mean, this is quite literally that we're waiting for. Please come in so we can start destroying you with our hands. You know, this, well, not quite literally with their hands, or maybe with their hands, but I mean, they're prepared. They're waiting. It's a fortress. Iran is it's the biggest fortress in the world. And just look at the map of it. Look at relief map of it. If you don't understand that this is a massive fortress that the U.S. military is absolutely incapable of taking. Maybe a few islands and then being plugged by drones and missiles nonstop day and night while casualties mount. Sure, they could do that. But anything significant? We're going to march to Tehran. Really? Have you looked at a map where Tehran is located? How many kilometers of mountains you're going to plan on marching through? Good luck there. This isn't a Hollywood movie. This is real life. And that's just the point. First of all, the logistic strain of the extreme. And the U.S. just physically does not have the capability of doing it. It is not a land power. It is a sea and air power. It is not a land power. The U.S. Army plus Marines is about 550,000 men, but that's not combat troops. There's maybe about 120,000 combat troops, and that's counting the National Guard, pulling the reserves. The rest is what we call ash and trash. It's combat support, which would be intelligence and engineers, and military police, and combat service support, which is everything else that 100 years ago or 120 years ago wasn't considered part of the army, but is now. The Teamsters, the mechanics, the cooks, the finance guys, the medics. You know, if you look at history books, what changed was, if you look at history books and it said, you know, so-and-so brought an army of 100,000 men, you figure these are all either pikemen or spearmen or swordsmen, whatever, infantry of some kind, or musketeers, cavalry, and artillery or catapults, whatever, depends on the decade or the century you're looking at. But they were all combat soldiers. But now what we're calling as an army is not all combat soldiers, because each one of these armies came with a long train of civilians, what they were called civilians or contracted civilians. Those were the people bringing in the supplies, fixing the damaged armor, or fixing the damaged musket or rifle, what have you, because the armies always traveled with this big train. By the way, the prostitutes came in there, and their wives came in there to wash their clothes. I mean, this whole human train that came, Napoleon came with the same thing into Moscow. Behind his army came a giant train of humanity that did all the jobs that needed to keep that army in the field. Now it's all called part of the military. It's military jobs. But again, they're soldiers, but they're not combat soldiers. They have minimal, if any, training to do any combat. They go to range once or twice, maybe once or twice practice bayonet tactics, once or twice practice some basic infantry skills. They don't remember it. They're not good at it. They're not made for that. But this is all part of the U.S. Army. So when they say, oh, we have 500,000 men, no, you don't. You've got 100, 120,000 you can throw into this meat grinder. There's over 1.5 million of Iranians waiting for revenge on home turf. And these are actual combat soldiers. They have the rest of society started right behind their back to do all the other jobs that need to be done. I mean, you're outnumbered 10 to 1. They're on the defensive and they're in mountains in prepared defensive positions. I mean, that's a suicide mission. And for the U.S. to start, recruitment every man at 18 has to sign up selective service. That's it. For selective service. I mean, I had to sign selective service and register with it. And what I've been told by people in the know is it's in such bad condition, it's going to take 4 or 5 months just to get it all organized. It's computerized, organized. And then start calling people in, and then you know you have to prepare these people. You start getting people in, you have to prepare these people. But then you get to the fact that 40% of Americans are obese, 30% of Americans are fat, but not morbidly obese. And the 30% that's left doesn't mean that they're all physically fit. It's just that their weight category isn't going into fat. You can deal with some of the fat and run it off, but that, by the way, takes more time. The U.S. Army last year in 2025 had an obesity rate. The U.S. military, I won't just say the Army, the U.S. military had an obesity rate of somewhere around 22-23%. When I served, I left in middle of 2004, in July of 2004, 18th July 2004, to be more exact, there wasn't a 1% obesity rate. It wasn't tolerated. But now when your recruitment is down so much as it is because you've sent people 6-7 rotations or 6-7 years into Iraq, into Afghanistan, and a place like that, you've used your human material up, and that human material went home and said, don't join the military. It's not worth it. You can't get enough people, so you start dropping the standards. And they drop and drop and drop, and now you have an obesity rate of 23%, 22-23%. It's insane. So every fourth soldier, if he runs 10 meters, he may collapse from a heart attack. I mean, you look at some of these people. When Trump called up the National Guard out of Texas, it became amply problem because they were all fat, and these were infantrymen, and they were coming out. They're like this big, and you're looking at us. Well, what the hell is he going to do? Except suck up bullets if something goes sour. He's a big target. He's not combat capable. You look at these guys. Seriously, the only thing they're combat capable of is taking out an all-you-can-eat food bar. I may say mean things, but this is the reality of combat. Combat is me. It's as mean a thing as a human being could do to another human being. It's to open up their guts or blast their head open. But that's what it is. And it's quite literally, if you're not fit, you don't survive. You may not survive even if you're fit. There's a massive amount of chance, whether that piece of shrapnel comes flying through your head or takes out your buddy's head or just misses you both. But if you're not fit enough to be able to sustain that kind of pressure, just die off. I mean, that's what it is. That's the reality of it. And this has been the U.S. military at this point. I mean, just to be absolutely brutally honest with it. And this is the military that Trump, by the way, and not a single general says anything counter because they all want their career afterwards. None of them will ever be held responsible. They want their million-dollar careers after their generalships are done when they retire. And these are the people that Trump wants to throw into combat against people that want revenge for their dead women and children, are fighting on their turf, and are a civilization that's lasted 5,000 years.
Well, I think when you call it Iran a fortress, I think that's a very good description, because people often forget that the country is almost four times the size of Iraq. It's pure mountains and again populated by 90 million people, and then you have the sea on the outside just, you know, to make it more difficult to storm the walls. So it's I think that's why the Foreign Minister Araghchi was making this point that, yes, please do send your troops. You know, the closer they come, the easier it will be to take them out. But as the US is sending, you know, a few thousand troops, it begs therefore the question, what exactly are they good for? And Karg Island, it seems too problematic, too difficult, unless they're sent over from Saudi Arabia. But even then, they're sitting ducks. But I was thinking that if Trump really wants to open up the Strait of Hormuz and gamble a lot on this, you also have these islands, especially three islands in near the Strait of Hormuz. It's Abu Musa, and then you have the Greater and Lesser Tumb Islands. It's interesting because they're claimed by United Arab Emirates ever since Iran took them in 1971. So, and suddenly now we see the UAE saying, "Oh, we might step up in the fight against Iran." Given that they're so, with what army? But where does this enthusiasm come from? It seems that this might be a trade-off. If the Americans are promising them these islands back, the U.S. gets control over the Strait of Hormuz, or more control at least, while UAE gets its old islands back. Again, speculation, but what do you see otherwise? What can a few thousand boots on the ground achieve here?
Well, no, I think it will go after these small islands, but here's the problem, or the coastline in northern coastline in Iran, which in a lot of places is relatively flat, but it runs into mountains not too far up. The problem is, whether you're on the islands or the coastline, what's the width of the entire, at the narrowest point, what's the width? 36 kilometers. You know what goes 50 kilometers? Especially if you have a retranslator drone sitting up there, the FPV drone. You can take an FPV drone with a big battery pack that can carry up to 20 kilograms of explosives. In other words, a couple of RPG rounds strapped to it. And you can go hunting Americans or UAE soldiers on those islands. And you can do this day in and day out. And especially those islands aren't 36 kilometers wide. You can take out any ships going through. First of all, because around the tip, the dredged canal, because these waters are not deep. These supertankers cannot go through these waters without beaching themselves. The dredged canal, which, by the way, has to be maintained and has to be dredged. I'm not quite sure how often they do it, but you got to consider that. But that dredged canal is 2,700 meters wide, right down the middle. It's about 18 kilometers in, right down the middle at the narrowest point. Yeah, and believe you me, a supertanker is a gigantic target. You put one or two of those out of commission in the middle of that, they got to be dredged out of there because nothing else is going to pass. I'm not sure whether an American destroyer can pass into the shallower waters or not. I'm not quite sure how shallow is water, but the supertankers can't. So right off the bat, you can easily close the gate, those gates that way. But those islands in the north, they're all within 15, 16 kilometers of the mainland or less. They're all within FPV drone range. You could set up 200-300 teenagers who've lost their families or lost their brothers and sisters and want revenge. Here's VR goggles, do a quick course on how to learn to power and control. Half of them probably already know how to control these drones. And here's a pair of VR goggles and a dozen drones. Go play hunt the Americans or hunt the UAE. And it becomes one big game, and they could be under every tree, under rock, try to find these guys. They're all separated out, maybe teams of two. Usually they run in teams of two. But that's the point is, you're talking, an investment of 400-500 people, and you could have 3,000-4,000 drones flying down, or a couple of drones for every Marine that landed on there. How do you get the wounded off? How do you supply them? And here's the other thing, MI6, because, it wasn't the Ukrainians, I'll call it what it is. MI6 attacked a Russian, a shadow fleet, if you want to, I don't consider them shadow fleet, a non-Lloyds of London insured ship off the coast of one of the Aegean islands. Using what? And this was, about 3 or 4 months ago? And they did it using what? They used FPV drones with RPG rounds attached to them, and they swarmed in there and they hit and they damaged and they set it on fire. Yeah, that could be used on any ship. No American ship will survive 100 drones flying in a wave. It's dumb. They will get through. At least you don't need that many to get through, especially with that much explosive power behind every single drone. And once it's damaged enough and burning, what do you do when that Aegis destroyer is on fire with a crew of 350 people? This is something that can cascade very quickly. So will they get used? Probably that's where they will get used. Will it be a suicide mission? It'll be just as much of a cluster as if they went after Karg, maybe even worse. And the Iranians are going to be within easy shooting range with everything they have to just keep lobbing into those islands. It's even easier to shoot those islands than Karg Island because they're much closer to the mountains and the mainland. So there is no good solution for Trump on land. There's only massive failure and casualties and a cluster and less massive. And the best thing is not to do it at all. More than likely, he's going to do it. That's where my opinion now is. I was hoping not, but he seems dead set on it because he doesn't know how to get out. And his only theory on how to get out of this is to double down, then triple down, then quadruple down, and do stupid down. Mr. Win Bigly, because he wins bigly, that's what his own words. He wins so big, he wins bigly. Mr. Win Bigly is going to make going to send a lot of men to their deaths. Going to leave a lot of orphan children and widows behind and parents without their sons and daughters because the moron cannot break and just take the punishment that he's got for doing something stupid like starting this war. Instead, he's going to just expand it. Unfortunately, I'd like things to be differently, to go differently. Yeah, but that's what I think we're facing, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's the problem with him trying now to fix the narrative by overselling the successes in this war. It makes so much more difficult to walk this one back and accept something less than a victory. So,
well, Glenn, there was a story that came out from an inside source just recently came out that said Trump's war briefings. Pardon my French. I shit you not when I say this. It's a crude saying, but I think it's very effective for this. First, a little bit of a background. I remember Tulsi Gabbard was talking about, we had to reform the daily security brief for Trump from the standard is here's 5-6 pages of information. Please read it, Mr. President. Trump doesn't like to read. So they had to reform the national security or the international security brief down to something that looked like a Fox News break, just little pieces instead of so Trump doesn't have to read something that covers like 15 minutes of watching. Well, having said that, and this is Tulsi admitted to this back about a year ago. Well, what the insider is saying is Trump's war briefs are about 3 minutes long and it's strike videos. U.S. Army or Navy or Air Force blowing stuff up. Nothing negative, no reality. I mean, what are you going to take out of an entire day worth of war in a flexible environment in 3 minutes? We're dealing with a very shallow human being who is not well-educated, no matter if he finished Ivy League schools. My God, his own mother, there was an interview with her when he was young, obviously. And what she said was, I know my son is an idiot and he's awkward socially, but he's my son and God help me, I love him. And please, if he goes into politics, it'll be a total disaster. That's a quote from his mother in an interview in the New York Times back about 40 years ago or so. But, his mother knew him best, obviously. And I've heard this from other people that have known Trump closely, very closely, including being in his entourage. In the 90s, when they were doing party drugs every couple of days and staying up all night and doing these wild parties, Atlantic City in New York. I've talked to these people. I'm friends with one of them. There was a former Navy SEAL who was in Trump's entourage. So, and they all say the same thing. He's not a deep person. He's a great marketing person, which is what This is the fall. This is why all republics die. Democracy, well, democracy is mob rule, but republics all die for the same one of the same reasons. It's marketing. It's a feel good popularity contest on elections. You don't get the best people. It's human nature. You get the guy that sells himself better than the other guy. That he may not be, he may be as dense as a brick, while the other guy's a genius that'll save you. Nah, but he's not as popular. It's a popularity contest. And then Trump won the popularity contest. He is a marketing guru. It doesn't go much deeper than that, though. And once you get into the White House or into the Kremlin or wherever you're in, whatever place you're in, now you have to start working. And if all that person has, in this case, Trump and a lot of the EU leaders, we see the same thing, is they can campaign well, they can sell themselves well, but there's nothing behind them, no knowledge base, no sternness, no concept of where they want to go. You get the message you get.
Well, this briefing consists of videos showing explosions. It could explain his confidence. So why things are going better than it is. Anyways, thank you so much for taking the time.